Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is mastering engineer Katie Devini. But let's start here. Mainstream success just isn't what it used to be. Everything that's big in music has gotten smaller over the years. Here's a few examples that will probably blow your mind. Michael Jackson shifted 500 million units at his peak. Taylor Swift has only done about 200 million. Now, you might say, wait a second, Michael Jackson was selling CDs at the height of CDs. Well, now they have something called album equivalent sales. And what that does is equate the number of streams to what would be a sale of a CD or an album. 1,250 streams from a premium tier or 3,750 from a free tier equals one album sale. So again, you think, oh, wait, Taylor Swift had 200 million, but it's been estimated that Michael Jackson would have had tens of billions if he'd been around today. And again, Taylor Swift has a lot of media these days. She's everywhere. She's on television. She's in newspapers. She's in magazines. But having mainstream media reach is not the same as being a mainstream artist in terms of listenership. Now, you might say the two things largely go hand in hand, and maybe they did once upon a time, but not so much anymore. So simply being bigger than the rest doesn't equate to being mainstream. Now, let's look at another example. The Eagles' Greatest Hits sold 38 million copies, just in the United States alone, and that was bought by 17% of the population. Michael Jackson's Thriller sold 34 million, and that was bought by 16% of the population of the United States. Taylor Swift's biggest release is about 2%, and her latest one is less than 1%. Meanwhile, Taylor's 26.1 billion Spotify streams in 2023 made her the most streamed artist of the year, but yet that was only 1.4% of all global Spotify streams. So what this comes down to is that being a big superstar is not as big as it used to be. People have short attention spans, and they get their entertainment other places. So anyone in music, even as big as Taylor Swift, just doesn't have the impact that they once had. If you have any comments or questions, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can find out all about my books, including The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, AI for Music Production, The Music Business Advice Book, and more at bobbyosinski.com. There you can also read excerpts from all of my books and learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter. That's bobbyosinski.com. Now, in honor of Father's Day, let's talk about dad rock. What is dad rock? It's rock music that appeals to an older generation or that is heavily influenced by what came in an earlier era. This is usually thought of as 80s and 90s rock music. Well, interestingly enough, the online merch site Merchoid did a study to find out all about the ultimate dad rock band, and they came down to 9 of them. Number one was Nickelback. 26% said they were the ultimate dad rock band. Van Halen and Blink 182 came in second at 12%. Red Hot Chili Peppers third at 10%, Nirvana at 10%, Linkin Park at 8%, Guns N' Roses 8%, Coldplay 6%, Bon Jovi 6%, and Limp Bizkit 2%. Now, the study went on to name every state's ultimate dad rock band, and I won't go through them all, but it's pretty interesting that Nickelback or Van Halen seem to come up on all of them as the most favorite dad rock band. But here's the thing that's interesting. 57% of people think today's music is worse than music from the past, while 40% think that today's tunes are just as good as the classics, and only 3% say that today's music is actually better. 41% believe that you become out of touch with modern music by the time you hit 35, and actually, that's kind of old because studies have found that it's actually 27. But what I think is most interesting is that 89% of respondents still enjoy listening to dad rock, proving that some songs are really timeless. So rock on, dads. My guest this week is five-time MPG Mastering Engineer of the Year, K. Katie Tavini, whose work includes Rudimental, Block Party, Ash, We Are Scientists, Nadine Shaw, Arlo Parks, Los Bichos, and many more. Since starting in 2014, Katie has grown to become one of the most in-demand mastering engineers in the UK, who's at home with everything from the heaviest metal to the luscious orchestral works and everything in between. Katie's also a founding member of Weird Jungle, a collective of independent mastering engineers in the UK dedicated to helping bands, artists, and labels release the best possible version of their work. During our interview, Katie talked about becoming a mastering engineer, how mastering has changed just in the last few years, things that mixers sometimes overlook, starting Weird Jungle, and so much more. I spoke with Katie via Zoom from her studio in Liverpool. Let's talk about when you first started, and let's just talk about getting into the music business first, because I know that there's a transition into mastering. I want to get to that in a little bit, but let's just talk about getting in the studio.
Yeah, it's hard. I did a degree in music, which was mainly classical music. And there was a really, really small studio module. It wasn't technical. We were just encouraged to use the studio as a tool to make music and to be creative. And I loved that so much. I don't think I would have done well on a technical course. I'm not a technical person. I just loved kind of being creative and, you know, seeing what would happen. And that was kind of my first experience of studios, you know. I'd never really seen one before. Yeah. So that was super cool. And then I got some work. One of my tutors at uni passed on some work in a studio to me, which was amazing. And to get that opportunity was like, oh God, it was just incredible. Because I was working with John Ellis, who's a keys player, and just one of the most talented and lovely people I've ever met in my life. And Bill Leader, who's a folk producer, and he was 80 when I started working with him. And so he'd basically seen every type of technology there was. And like, his discography is just crazy big. So to get to work with those guys was just like, yeah, it was really special. And I feel so lucky to have had that as my kind of entry into kind of studio world. I mean, I didn't know anyone who worked in music. I didn't know anything. I didn't know, you know, I was literally just there like thinking, wow, this is so cool. And that was it. Like, I didn't ever think, oh, maybe this could be a job or a career or anything. I was just thinking, I'm just going to enjoy this while it lasts.
Were you thinking about a career in music at that point, and you weren't interested in the studio other than the wow factor?
I didn't know what careers there were in music. I had no idea. And I knew I loved recording and being in the studio and kind of vibing with people creatively, and knew that I didn't want to like do something. I'm a behind the scenes person. I didn't want to do anything kind of, you know, too upfront or anything. But other than being a music teacher, I didn't know what careers there were. And so I was just kind of, you know, going along with the studio work, like engineering, and just kind of, I guess, just seeing what happened.
Yeah.
But I never thought of it as a, you know, maybe this could be a job. I was like literally just having a really nice time and seeing how long it would last.
Well, when did it become a job for you?
I mean, studio engineering was kind of a job off and on until about 2013. So from 2009 to 2013. But I did my first master in 2011, which was purely by accident. Like, I didn't know what mastering was. I didn't have a clue. I just got asked to master something, and said no at first. And then, you know, this person who I still work with was very persuasive. And I said, listen, please don't use this if it's bad, but I'll have a go. Yeah, we, in the end of this project, we got something that we were really happy with. And I started getting quite a lot of work off the back of that. And I still never really thought it could be a job. I was just enjoying it and just thinking, well, now I need to learn as much about mastering as possible. So I did that. Like, I learned as much about mastering as possible. And, you know, I had other jobs, like other day jobs during that. I worked as an engineer at the British Library, archiving the sound archive, digitizing the sound archive, which was amazing. Like, mainly doing open reels, but sometimes you'd get really weird formats, yeah, like Dictabelt. Who's played a Dictabelt before?
Whoa. Wow.
Like, you know, that was really fascinating. So, yeah, I did archival work for a bit. I've done a marketing job. I've done more bar work than I can even count, honestly. I've taught violin. I've taught music theory. So I just kind of, I think I was just seeing what was out there, because I didn't really know, like, no one, I didn't know you could be a mastering engineer, and I didn't know that you could be a mastering engineer and not work in London at a big mastering house. I didn't know that that was an option. Didn't know anything about being freelance, which, you know, is a thing. And yeah, I was just kind of enjoying doing mastering alongside all of these other jobs. And
when did you decide that, okay, I'm kind of good at this, I think I want to do mastering all the time?
So I went part-time at my archival job in January 2020. And so I was archiving 3 days a week and mastering 3 days a week. And that's when stuff started getting really, really busy. And when the pandemic hit, I still had my archival job, which was part-time, but I kept on getting asked to do masters. And I was like, oh, I can't, like, you know, yeah, this is starting to take over. So in, yeah, August 2020 was my first month of mastering full-time. And it was wild. Like, you know, when you get asked to do something cool and you think, oh, I'll just do it. I'll just do it first and then I'll think about it afterwards. It was very much like that. I was just thinking, I'll just do this and I'll just, you know, I'll think about it afterwards. And I kept thinking that. And then it got to the point where I was so busy that I was starting to have to work with other mastering engineers. And I was like, cool, I'll think about it afterwards. Yeah. And it wasn't until perhaps, I don't know, 6 months ago that I was like, oh shit, this is my job and I get to do this every day. That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of been, it's been a slow journey, but I don't think I would have wanted it to. I mean, it's felt really fast to me, but, you know, considering my first master was in 2011, that is kind of a long time ago. But I don't think I would have wanted it to go any faster than that, because I've really enjoyed the process of learning slowly without having any pressure, and kind of, you know, having a day job had allowed me to play with mastering and kind of just meet people and learn and ask questions, which I think is really important.
Okay, here's a question for you that I ask all mastering engineers. How long did it take you before you felt that, oh, I'm good at this, I have my arms around it?
I'll let you know when I feel like that.
But like, honestly, that's the general response I get.
Like, sometimes I have days where I'm like, cool, this felt really good. And then sometimes I have days which are just such wild learning curves. And that feels good in a completely different way. But I think because mastering is so quick a process, really, compared to mixing or production or engineering in the studio, you're never stop learning. And that's something that I really love about it, is that it is just like, I don't think I'm ever going to be finished learning. It's just, you know, and I think mastering has evolved quite a bit. And just, I don't know, I'm getting asked to do different things now than I was like when I started mastering.
Give me an example.
So, like when I started mastering, no one was making CDs. Whereas now every project I work on, people want CDs.
Wow.
And like, I feel like vinyl sides have always been a thing, but like people are really pushing sync now. So like instrumentals and TV mixes are like really, really important. Whereas, you know, I think 5 or 6 years ago, I didn't see much of that. So getting those alt versions kind of mastered to a really high quality is very important to a lot of people. Like it's interesting to see artists not just pushing the main release, but also, you know, trying to do other stuff with their music, which is really cool. So I feel like, you know, when I started mastering, I thought it was just like mastering a record. And then, you know, like I got asked for FLAC files the other day.
Wow.
I've not been asked for FLAC files for, I don't know, years and years, maybe only once ever before. But just kind of, yeah, just being sort of like, oh, okay, how do I make these FLAC sound good? I'm going to do some research in that.
Mm.
I mean, cassette sides are really like having their moment, which is cool. You know, I love tape. That's very cool. And then been seeing some stuff get released on FlexiDisc as well. I don't know if people play the FlexiDiscs, but, you know, they tend to be like a bonus release.
I'm shocked.
When people, yeah. So like if people are doing like a vinyl release, they might do like a few different colors of vinyl, but then they might do a really limited edition one, which comes with a FlexiDisc. I really don't know if people play them, but I still want, you know, I still want it to sound okay. I mean, they're never going to sound incredible, but like, yeah, just kind of just making sure, like being aware, like when I first found out that people were putting music on FlexiDisc, I didn't even know about it beforehand. So it's like, I need people to tell me this now. So I think something that's really changed is, so I have an amazing booking manager, Carla, who will collect as much information as possible about a release before I work on it. And she started asking for like, you know, be really specific when you tell us what formats you want so that we can, you know, we can really do our best when it comes to making them. But it's always a learning curve. Like it's just, I think it's always a conversation with people, and no project is ever the same. So yeah, I don't think I'll ever be finished learning, but.
Okay. Typically then, what are the masters that you're asked for? You mentioned a lot of CD and I guess a streaming master and Apple Digital Master, I guess, right?
Yeah, so I remember when they were MFITs, and they were like, I made a lot of those in like 2017, 2018. They really had their moment, but again, they're coming back. Like, I've made loads this morning already, and it's cool. Like, it's cool that people are asking for these formats and thinking about how their music is going to sound.
Okay, so when you're doing the different formats, then that require a different master in terms of different levels, and are you approaching each one differently then?
Yeah, so the Apple Digital Masters require basically no inter-sample peaking on the audio. So Apple have like a little widget that you install and you run stuff through there and just check it. It generally ends up being a little bit quieter than the main master, but like, yeah, it's pretty much the same. vinyl sides are interesting. I always provide a dynamic version and a loud version so that whoever's cutting the vinyl can choose. Because something I didn't know is that all lathes are different, and it makes sense that whoever's operating their lathe knows it best. And so, you know, there's loads of advice on the internet of like, oh, you've got to mono the bass and you've got to roll off the top end and all of that kind of stuff. But after speaking to some different cutting engineers, they're like, no, just make sure that like the music sounds as good as it can be. And like dynamics are always appreciated. So yeah, I've kind of been in dialogue with a couple of people just about that to see, you know, I just always want things to sound as good as they can be. I don't think that ever stops. And I think like as mastering engineers, we've got to be prepared for someone to go, oh no, actually we'd like it like this now. Like this is, we've discovered that this sounds better. And you've got to be willing to go, cool, let's dive into that and have a conversation.
How about lust levels? Is that something that you worry about?
No.
Yeah. And it's funny because the rest of the music world is obsessed with this, and mastering engineers in general are going, why? And I see the same thing. It's like, it gets encoded anyway. No matter what you do, it gets re-encoded by the streaming service. So what's the point?
I just feel like if you can make a release sound as good as it can possibly sound, then that's your job done. Like, I feel like streaming services are constantly going to change their, like, the numbers and stuff on their side. I don't even know what you'd call it. Their, like, the way they process audio.
Yeah, they're encoding. So yeah.
It doesn't make sense to optimize stuff for what Spotify wants now when they're probably going to change their mind in a year or two. But also, then that opens the question of, if you're going to care about what Spotify wants now, are you also going to care about the other streaming platforms? In which case, you'll probably end up sending like loads of different masters out. But, you know, when artists upload to distributors, it's really rare that they can upload both an Apple Digital Master and a master as well. You know, it's like some platforms like, you upload both, but other times they're like, well, what do I upload? And I'm like, well, let's just stick with the main master, but high quality, you know, the biggest file size that the platform will accept, because, you know, that way Tidal's happy. It has the master thing on there. That way Spotify can class it as high quality or whatever they've called it now. But it's like, it's just not possible to kind of, to upload that many different versions. So, you know, you might go, oh, I want this to be like whatever amount of love Spotify is asking for, but then that might sound rubbish on a different platform. So I really just believe if you can make just the music sound as good as it possibly can, it will sound good anywhere.
Yeah, it translates. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. Is there a common problem that you see with some masters that you get?
Ooh.
In other words, bass light or distortion or, you know, something like that.
No, I think, I think that there is sometimes things that are overlooked, and that can be when people are printing really large projects and, you know, printing all of the alt versions. So sometimes just one backing vocal will end up not muted in the instrumental version or something like that. Like, that's what I'm listening for. Or like tiny little clicks and pops that probably no one else will notice, but I feel them physically when they happen. And so I'm getting rid of stuff like that. But I think, like, you know, the mixes that I get sent and the people that I work with all have really distinctive styles and really, really kind of intentionally know what they want. And they've got kind of this vision of what they want the music that they're working on to sound like. You know, I have had stuff that's very distorted, but good distorted, not clipping.
Yeah, intentionally distorted, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's a conversation of like, do we play on that? And I do I make it more distorted? Like, do I saturate it even more? Or do I do a really clean master and just what you've done is enough? I think, you know, in the pandemic when people were working from home, you know, the studios were closed for a little bit and people were working on systems which, you know, were not familiar or not super familiar to them, or maybe working on headphones and just doing what they had to do. I was finding kind of the low end was sometimes not present enough, but I had been working on my system. Like, I carried on mastering on, you know, my system for a while. So I was able to kind of trust what I was hearing and be able to feed that back. And, but, you know, I think now that most mix engineers that I know work from a studio, but then will also have headphones that they know really well. I think that's not really a thing I encounter so much anymore. I think the times where I'm going back and forth on a mix now is like really creative stuff, which is super, super fun. Had a mix the other week, which me and the mix engineer were talking about, like, how can we make the breakdown pop? Like, does that snare need to come off a little bit? Like, it had these wild synthy guitar sounds in. Like, how can we make those just like, you know, it needs to be a breakdown, that it needs to come down, but how can it also stand out by itself without feeling like too much of a drop in energy? So it's kind of conversations like that, which, yeah, that's kind of what I love the most.
That's being very creative then on your side. A lot of mastering engineers are, you know, not willing to do that. They master with blinders on, so to speak. This is what I do. So that's cool.
I think there's this expectation of mastering engineers to sometimes just process the audio quality check, make formats and send it back. But I have come from a more creative background. I'm not a technical person. Like, you know, I've really had to work on the technical stuff. But I think my favorite projects are always the ones where the mix engineer or the producer or the artist is up for having a conversation. There's a band called Los Bichos, and they've just had two new singles out. And that was super cool because the producer, Ollie, was just basically like, you know, we had a FaceTime call before I started working on the mixes, and he was kind of describing, you know, what they were thinking about when they were making the record. And, you know, but he said, I want you to go nuts. And I was like, oh, okay. So we threw a couple of ideas around, and I sent him a first draft. We just did one track. I was like, let me just do this before I make the whole of the album sound this way. And he was like, I really like it. Can you make it more of this? I was like, yeah, of course I can. And so we decided to get that one song to a place where we were both happy, and then kind of make the rest of the album match it. But like that, you know, being given the freedom to play and have creativity, I really appreciate that. But, you know, not all projects need that. Not all people want that, and that's fine as well.
Is there a genre of music that you find more difficult to master than others? Or just, is there some type of music, some style that you just find to be more difficult?
I can tell you what I kind of find easiest.
Okay.
So I really enjoy working on kind of indie rock, electronic music, and really enjoy working on classical music as well, because I have quite a strong background in that. I do feel like I just don't have as much practice in kind of pop and hip-hop and R&B. I do master those genres, but I don't necessarily find them harder. I just am less practiced in them, but I do enjoy them when they come along.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing about mashing is, like, you can be working on any type of music, and that's so beautiful.
Okay, so tell me about your signal path. I can sort of see behind you that there's some analog gear there.
There is. So I never really have the same signal path. Some people will talk about kind of a go-to mastering chain. I don't really have that. I try and kind of listen to the music and think about what it needs before I do anything. And if it doesn't need much, then that's cool. Or if I'm like, oh, maybe I can just, do a little bit this, do a bit this, then I start adding stuff in. But it's kind of, it's very, where does the music take me? Rather than, I'm just going to use all these things because I have them.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a bit of a less is more fan. So, like, I think all my favorite masters have been really kind of like carefully considered. Whereas the ones where, like, so I still practice mastering because I feel like it's my job, like a musician will practice their instrument outside of their sessions. I practice mastering outside of my sessions. And, sometimes if I'm practicing, I have decided just to throw everything at it. And it never sounds fresh to me. Like it never feels exciting. It feels too much. And I never want music that I'm, working on with artists and bands to feel like it's too much.
Ken Scott told me a story. Ken Scott, the famous engineer producer for the Beatles and Supertramp and whatever. And of course, he came up in the EMI system where before you become an engineer, they send you to mastering for a year or two. And he told me that the first week in mastering, and of course, they didn't have many tools. All they had was an EQ and a compressor. But he said the first week, you turn everything up. And you put everything on it, and then you decide, oh, wait a second, that doesn't sound that good. And then you go back to just, little tweaks here and there. But I think that's common where you figure, I have these tools, let's use them, but it doesn't work that way, does it?
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I've never, obviously big fan of Ken Scott, but haven't heard that before. And, I think it's interesting seeing kind of online in, engineering and mastering forums, people are just always talking about like new plugins that come out and new pieces of gear. And I'm like, I probably have like 6 plugins in total. Mm. It's not because I don't think technology is cool. It's just because like they all kind of the same. I don't want to feel overwhelmed when I'm, I go, oh, I want a limiter. Well, I know that I have 3 limiters and they all sound really different. And I've got a hardware limiter. So actually that's 4. But I want to know that, if I've got a sound in my head, I go, right, I need that one, pull it up. And I know exactly how to get the sound that I'm looking for. I don't want to be staring at a plugin folder with like 60 different limiters going, well, they're all kind of the same, but they all do sound different. I don't know which one I want. Like, I want to be able to go, no, I know it, that one. I think, is it choice paralysis that people call it?
Yeah.
I don't want that to kind of come into my work at all.
Okay. Tell me about Weird Jungle. How did that come about?
Well, yeah, it's a journey. So, like, I'd kind of had the idea in my head for like a mastering house, but a virtual mastering house when I was working at the British Library doing archival work there. And the reason for that was because I was surrounded by all these amazing engineers. We all had our studios down there. I think there was about 10, 12 of us. But the bits, we were all quite isolated in our studio until we went for lunch, or we went for a brew, or, you know, something, or to the pub or whatever. And then, you know, you'd just be having a conversation and someone would just drop some wisdom and you'd be like, yes, ah, this is life changing. And kind of those are the times where I learned the most. And so I was like, oh, if I ever do mastering as a job, like, wouldn't it be cool? Because I knew that I didn't want to, like, really be in London for very much long. But so I was like, I know that it's probably very unlikely that I'll work at a big mastering house because they're all in London. But wouldn't it be cool if there was, like, a virtual mastering house where you could be working with other engineers, but not kind of relying on a location? And then in 2020, I met Stephen Kerrison through a friend who's also called Stephen. And, like, we just realized that we had the same ethos when it comes to mastering, which was, like, it just all felt really natural. He's also really kind of into very new artists and making sure that artists are well looked after and kind of prioritizing the music rather than, you know, any Spotify numbers and that kind of stuff. Like, the music comes first. And so we got on really well. And then in 2021, I was basically getting booked up about 5 months in advance, which for mastering is quite unheard of.
That's unusual, yes, I'd say. Yeah. Good for you.
Like, mastering's normally quick, like, you know, normally it's a quick process. But so it was kind of like, well, I feel bad keeping people waiting, but also I don't just want to send people into Google. Like, if people are coming to me and they're trusting me to work on their art, I don't want to send them out into the world where it's chaotic and you don't know, you know, you could Google mastering engineer and get like so many different results. How do you know that you're going to end up working with someone who cares about your music? So I started working with Stephen in 2021, and my bookings manager would basically say, Katie's available these times, but we also work with another mastering engineer, Stephen Kerrison, who's available a little bit sooner if you'd like to work with him. And, you know, a lot of people wanted to wait for me, and that, like, that's just incredible. But also a lot of people just couldn't wait for me. And so we were passing the work on to Stephen. He was doing an amazing job. Artists and bands were feeding back and saying, thank you so much for putting us in touch. We're so happy with the way the project came out. I was like, this is a thing. And, you know, also Stephen and I were in touch on a daily basis and kind of really talking about work, like, in a way that is not just asking questions on a forum and getting, like, one-word answers and people, like, replying as if you're an absolute idiot. But we were actually having, you know, in-depth conversations about work and how we can make, you know, how we can improve. Like, have you tried this? You know, oh, I used this technique today and this was really successful. Like, so that was amazing. And I think we both really grew as engineers from the process. So at that time as well, I'd also been mentoring another engineer called Izzy McPhee, who we were introduced by Saffron Music, which is a label and a company that supports women and gender minorities in the music industry. And when I started mentoring Izzy, she wanted to be a mix engineer. But she, like, you know, and I was just kind of, I wasn't pushing her into mastering at all. But she came to me one day and she said, I've mastered a song for someone on this program that I'm doing. Can you listen to it and can you give me some feedback? I was like, yeah, of course. That's brilliant that you've given mastering a go. Like, did you enjoy it? Said you enjoyed it. And I listened to the master and I was like, you sure you want to be a mix engineer? Like, you know, it was naturally just really tasteful and spot on, and way better than my first ever master was. Like, she just has this kind of, she just, I think because she's been a DJ for many years previously, she just knows what music should sound like. And I was like, this is really, really good. So she decided that she enjoyed mastering, which was amazing. And I invited her to join me and Stephen. And so basically Weird Jungle is myself, Stephen Kerrison and Izzy McPhee, mastering engineers. And then it's run by Carla Harding, who is a manager, and she does all of our kind of bookings and inquiries and day-to-day. And then her husband, Brendan Harding, who does kind of like bigger picture management, so sort of direction, business planning, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's a small team, but it's so much fun. It's so much fun working with people who, like, want to push each other and really care and give a shit. I think if I wasn't doing this now, I think if Weird Jungle wasn't a thing, I would be very lonely at work.
Okay, speaking of which, mastering engineers has a lot, just care about the music for the most part and are really into it as fans, as engineers, and that really takes what you do to another level. But now we have lots of mastering plugins, so-called mastering plugins, online mastering. There's a lot of competition that's less expensive. And also, I think there are many engineers, artists, whatever, that feel, oh, I can do this. How do you feel about that?
Honestly, fine. Like, I think the fact that there are options is only a good thing. Like, I remember when, you know, the first project, when I was an engineer, that I got to kind of witness go through the mastering project. Like, we sent the project off as an ISO file on a CD, and then it came back as, like, I think 3 CDs all labeled like Redbook Master. And like, it all felt very intimidating. I didn't understand any of it. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like if you were an artist and you were making your own music without an engineer and without a producer, you'd understand even less. Like, you know, I was working with an engineer and I had no idea. I was working as an engineer. And like, I just, yeah, that was very, I had no idea what had happened. All I knew is we'd sent this file I'd never heard of off on a CD in the post. And we'd had 3 CDs come back. Like, there was no conversation. There was no kind of, like, it felt a bit impersonal. It felt like, yeah, a bit weird. So I think the fact that there's options is a good thing. Like, people are making music in different ways now. Like, some people do go to big studios, but also there's a lot of bedroom producers. And, like, their music is equally as amazing. But if someone, you know, if someone's making music as a hobby, they're probably, like, not going to want to release their music on vinyl, maybe. Or they might not have budget to come to a mastering engineer. Or they might just be curious about the process. They might be like, I want to make this project by myself. And that's totally valid.
Yeah, see, I always thought that people that do this aren't aware, have never worked with the mastering engineer, and it's the same thing with the producer, where people self-produce and they've never worked with the real producer and don't understand what another person can bring to the project and how it could be better as a result. And that's what happens with mastering. It's like, oh yeah, well, I can do this, there's all this, I don't really need that person, without understanding what, you know, all the good that can come from having another set of ears on it.
I mean, I'm a massive believer in collaboration. Like, I think, like, a a solid team is like one of the best things that you can do for your music. But there's so much music being made for so many different reasons that having options like, you know, using an online mastering, like AI mastering, you know, if a band's got some demos and they just want to make them a bit louder to take to a producer, then an automated mastering, that's a good, you know, if it's going to sort of make their demos kind of just, you know, gel together or something a little bit more than they were. And if that gives the producer a better idea of the route that they want to take, then that's a good thing. I think there is a lot of worry about AI mastering, but it's not really mastering. All it is audio processing. You know, we spoke at length about formats, but AI mastering is not going to do that. It's not going to make final sides. It's not going to tell you if there's a little bit of talking left on the end of a vocal mic. You know, maybe you've forgotten to cut that off. It's not going to go and tell you to crossfade your edits.
Yeah,
It's not going to do that. It's not going to quality check your music. And yeah, it won't make your formats for you. So I think it's kind of mislabeled. I think it's audio processing. Now, whether that's good or not, I don't know.
Yeah. But that's a good way to think about it, though.
That's a whole other question. For example, I like every decision I make in mastering to be very intentional and considered. Like, I'm a music fan first and foremost, and that's how I master is like, how do I want this to sound when I'm listening as a fan? AI is not going to give you that, but it might make it louder and brighter. And you know, if you're a band and you've just recorded a demo in GarageBand or something so that you can take it to a producer, you might not know what an EQ is. Like, so if you can run it through something that, like, you know, just makes it a little bit brighter and more exciting, you're going to feel more excited about the whole process. That's, you know, I don't know. I'm not trying to defend AI mastering because I think, like, it feels like companies who invest heavily in that are only doing it because they can and because they want to make more money. They're not doing it from a place of, like, curiosity or a place of caring about audio quality. So I'm not defending it, but I do think, you know, it has its place. I think, so Ozone has a master assist function, and I've never used it, but the first masters I did were in Ozone, and they were so trial and error, but I got there.
Yeah.
And that's all that counts. However, I think if the master assist function had been a tool when I was first starting out, that would have been such an amazing learning tool, because I could have used that, seen what that was doing, and then go, okay, that's doing that. Why is that doing that?
Yeah.
Do I want to do any of that? Yes or no? Like, do I think that's kind of helping? Is this function that it's doing something that I need to think about? Do I need to learn more about that? So I feel like that could be a really good educational tool.
See, what I always tell people is, if you're going to use that, make sure you use Master Assistant, but then do what it tells you. Because what I think the problem that most people have is they'll go, oh yeah, but it needs just a little more of this and a little more of that, where then they go completely off the rails, where if they just listen to Master Assistant, it's going to be a lot better than, you know, trying to do it yourself. If you don't know what to do, you know, if you're coming from it, well, I don't know how to do this, so do it for me. Well, then let it do it for you.
Yeah, I agree. You can kind of get, you know, hung up on, like, you know, I think some of my earlier masters, some of them I had the opportunity to remaster quite recently, and I wasn't using my early masters as a reference at all. I'd kind of just you know, put them out of my brain. But now comparing the two, I was like, oh, I just was making them brighter because it was making me more excited about how the music felt rather than because it needed it. And now I listen to it, I'm like, oh, that's just way too bright. So I think you can just totally go overboard because you're getting excited.
Everybody does that. Everybody does that, yeah. Even on their mixes. They go, oh, they listen to a mix from 10 years ago, 5 years ago, last year. And they go, oh, I can do that better. So that's just part of the game.
Yeah.
Last question, Katie. And you mentioned that you've had, you know, a journey, and you've talked about your journey, and it's pretty interesting. So this is a good question for you. What's the best piece of advice that maybe you received from somebody or you learned along the way?
I've had a lot of really good advice, actually. However, I think the best piece of advice I've ever had has been from Mandy Parnell, and she told me to keep myself healthy, like go to the gym, eat well, get sleep, look after yourself. She said, if you don't do that, you can't work. And if you don't do that, you're not going to do your best work. And you know what? Like leaning over this all day is hard on your back. And yeah, I go to the gym and I strength train because it just, yeah, like it keeps me pain free. And like, I know, like, it doesn't seem like it would make a big difference, but it really does. Like, you just can't do your best work. And I think mastering music is a physical thing, and mastering is a physical thing. Like, I can feel in my body when there's too much of a certain frequency, which sounds really crazy, but like, you know, I can kind of like, there's places in my brain where I can just feel it if there's like, you know, just a little bit too much 3K or something just really kind of gets me. And I think if you don't look after your body, you're not gonna know that. Like if you're experiencing pain, you're not gonna know. So yeah, that's my kind of top tip that I was given, and I kind of think about that a lot. And so yeah, I would pass that on to anyone.
You can find out more about Katie at katietavini.co.uk. That's Katie Tavini, KATIETAVINI.co.uk. And you can find out about Weird Jungle at weirdjungle.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.